Coming up, actor John Hurd joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. My lovely co-host, Tamara Berg. How are you?
Hi, everybody. I'm great. How are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm having a great summer, and I'm very excited today because we're going to be talking to actor John Hurd. And I thought it'd be fun to talk today just about movies. I saw John's in so many movies. Mm-hmm. I also saw him on the street, I think.
Oh, is that right?
Well, when I was going to acting school.
Yeah.
He was always doing a lot of theater and everything. But my mom took me away. I had so many childhood experiences of going to the Revival House. And I was very lucky to see on a double bill Chilly Scenes of Winter and Between the Lines. And I got to know... I think I got to know pretty much everyone in the cast.
Really? Yeah. As you went on in your career?
Jeff Goldblum, Bruno Kirby, of course, John Hurd. And it's always like that surreal, that's to me one of the greatest things about being in show business, is like having that experience of seeing someone in a movie and then actually getting to you know, work
of
with
course.
Them or become friends and find as part of the whole genesis of why I wrote the book and why we did the show. So John is certainly in that category.
Right. So that experience also works for other people who see you in movies and then come. So how have you had anyone come to you and go, oh, my God, I loved you in...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people are, you know, I love, you know, film fans, people mm-hmm. who, you know, there's so many movies I've done that are, you know, more that maybe they've done better with the fans than they've done out in the marketplace, you know, cult movies, I guess you'd sort of call them. And for me, it's the fans that keep you going. They see the little nuances in the performances. Yeah. And what I love about fans is a movie, like you could do a movie and it'd be interesting to have, you know, John speak to this too. Mm-hmm. You can a movie can be 20, 30 years old.
Sure.
And for someone who sees it last week, you know, to them, it's, you know, it's timeless. There's that timeless quality.
Absolutely. I mean, we had Peter Bogdanovich on the show, and he talked quite a bit about What's Up, Doc.
Yeah.
And which was one of those movies that I saw lots when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, shot in San Francisco, which is the, grew up in the Bay Area. And so that movie had, you know, so many layers mm-hmm. of delight, really, for me to watch. And to have him sitting right here in this very chair that I'm sitting in and hear him talking about all of his, you know, inside experiences and how, you know, the chase mm-hmm. scenes and that kind of thing was incredibly exciting for me.
I think it's so important. And again, this is another thing that I'm going to ask John about.
Yeah.
Just because it's a kick for me, in New York in the 80s. And there was, I got there, I think it was 80. I always forget, 82 or 83. Mm-hmm. And it was they had this place called Cafe Central. And the famous thing, of course, was that Bruce Willis was the bartender there. And,
oh, wow.
But it was a place, again, where you could feel the excitement. You could, you know, you could dream. Like, we were in acting school. We didn't have any money to go in Cafe Central. But we could stand outside the sidewalk and kind of be like, we hear important, famous people are in there, and you
oh
know,
my gosh.
People that were doing Broadway or off Broadway,
sure,
and things like that. And there's so few experiences, and again, places to kind of keep up that history of actors talking to actors. You know, the businesses. There's what I always my constant complaint, as you know, is like there's never enough time to tell stories on set anymore. You know, you're shooting something in 10, 16 days. And in the old days, you'd come in, you'd rehearse, and you'd really, really get a chance to know people and know actors and hear their stories. And it's so important for me to get people's, I don't know, histories of, you know, of all these great films that have really, you know, affected us. As opposed to just watching the movie. I like hearing from every kind of member of the of the cast. So
that's kind of what we get to do here.
I know. I love it. So we should probably go ahead, because we're going to have a lot to talk about with actor John Hurd, of course, who's known. I mean, these movies, you've been in everything, John. Cutter's Way, of course, which has become a classic. Cat People, Chud, Chilly Scenes of Winter, as well as After Hours, another movie I love. Big, Beaches, Big. Awakenings, Rambling Rose, another great movie. Pelican Brief, Milagro, Beanfield War, Snake Eyes with John DePalma. I'm looking at you in the corner of my eye. And, of course, he played Peter McAllister in Home Alone and Home Alone 2. He won an Emmy for guest starring in The Sopranos, and he's also an amazing theater actor. He was in The Streamers and many, many other great films. Please welcome actor John Hurd.
Yay.
Actor and clown John Hurd. John, what's going on?
Hey!
What's going on, John?
New Korea! I'm the Monterey clown.
Well, now
aren't these supposed to be like buy one of these and it means you're contributed to something?
Red Nose Day.
Red Nose Day. Yeah, it was a couple weeks ago, but I appreciate the effort. So John, we always do the show. We were talking about movies. Do you remember the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
Oh my God! I think it was my mother. Mm-hmm. I don't know. She's gone now. So, I grew up with a bunch of Catholic boys in grade school, and I think it was my birthday, and we went to the Avalon Theater in Chevy Chase, Maryland, Washington D.C., right on the District Line, and it was a Fernandel movie, he's a Spanish comic.
Uh-huh.
And, we were like, 14 years old or whatever, and nobody got it. We all sat there like, why did we come to see this movie? It's not funny. It's subtitled. I mean, it was like, my mother, remember when Shirley Scenes of Winter, Gloria Graham, when she says the joke's on you and no dinner?
Of course. It's
kind of my mother's, birthday present.
So when you were... So after that, I mean, growing up in a Catholic, did they show movies, in the school, or did you always have to go out to see movies?
Catholic school, did they show movies? No.
Not in the
grade school, no. And no movies in high school, no.
Wow.
We had the theater.
It
was a boys' Jesuit school, and we did Chaucer, we did... Just it's so funny now because they're doing that production at Joe Papp of Caesar.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes,
and they're all upset because
the modern Caesar connection
stabbed 1,000 times.
Yes,
and he's being played by Donald Trump. And that was the first play. It was a one act play contest. It was an adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an actor who's also in the debating. His name was Al Maloney, and Al had like 5 o'clock shadow every day. Mm-hmm. in high school. He was a big Italian guy, big barrel chested guy, and he had like almost a beard by the end of every day. And he played Cassius, Jan, and hungry, lean and hungry, whatever. Cassius is supposed to be the skinny guy, not Al. And Al, my first showbiz moment was we were wearing the sheets, the toga. Mm-hmm. We had a little platform. We put the king's chair on it, and we did the adaptation. My nose keeps itching. I'm sorry. And
the price you pay for comedy.
Al Maloney grabs me downstage, right all the way down, a big proscenium march in the auditorium, and he grabs me and he says, "Casca, you are the first to rear your hand." He was Italian, and that was my first. And then I proceeded to trip over the only platform on stage.
Oh God!
I turned quickly to try to stab Caesar, and I don't know why I thought of that, but I did. But that's
how did the audience react? Did you get laughs or?
Fine. Not only once, but in a blackout later, you had to go from one side of the stage to the other. I tripped again.
Oh.
And I was singled out at the end of the one-act play contest as a guy that, had trouble.
Well,
the stage. It was fun.
Making a mark. It was.
Yes. So were there, did you know right away? Now, you grew up in D.C. and your dad was.
Yeah, I grew up in Washington, D.C.
Did you know, did you have a, you know, think that you were going to go into the theater, be an actor, or go to the movies?
Oh, no idea. No. No, I was the screw up.
Really?
And my older sister, Cordis is her name, she was trying to convert the garage into a theater. You know, and my mother was in the community theater, the Cedar Lane Community Players or something. My mother said, why don't you get off your butt and do something? And I said, like, what? And she said, I don't know, something, you know, you got to do something. Yeah. My mother always said, you know, John, you have to take an interest in things. And then she'd stare at a porcelain frog on Fifth Avenue. But she was instrumental. She was very much, you know, she didn't make it to theater. She didn't say, you know, go go be an actor or anything.
Right.
But with an older sister and my mother, and then at my high school, I was like incredibly fortunate to be in the company of these two guys, Glenn Embry and Al Maloney. They were super. They were in the brain class. They were gifted students, and they were gifted actors in high school. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. They were really good. So you had to kind of step up with those guys in the school play.
I was talking.
They took it seriously.
Oh, what's? Are these,
they
some,
took it seriously.
Yeah. The no, I was distracted because there was banging in the back.
Yeah, they're renovating this place and kicking us all out.
Well, that's not great.
That's an actor's life, man.
That is, isn't it? Rooms.
If men go by with ladders behind you, I'm going to be in trouble. Anyway, so we were talking about New York in the 1980s, and your first theater, the play, which, you know, then we were all doing it for scene work, people, streamers. Was that one of your first big plays?
Streamers?
Yeah.
No, Streamers, I had been lucky enough to work with the PAP organization and done the theater, done in the park. As a matter of fact, we were in a production of Hamlet when I got cast to go and do Streamers at the Longworth Theater with Arvin Brown and Mike Nichols.
Oh, wow.
He needed to fire all of us.
He did?
Yeah.
And
it was a big deal. It's strange. I don't know if it still happens, but it was a real rallying point. I remember going into the Cedar Tavern Friday night after hearing that we'd been replaced when the show came to New York. And everybody knew about it. Everybody, all the actors that used to congregate there on a Friday night, you know, John Lithgow, even Al Pacino used to sneak in wearing a, you know, a fake nose or something. The word was that the three actors had been replaced in this new play by David Rabe, and I was one of them. And they were very. It was when you got a real firsthand taste of the kind of tribal or camaraderie amongst theater people.
Well,
I don't know if that's so true in the movies, but it's certainly true of the theater.
No, I was saying before.
And it was true of the theater then, especially. I don't know how much it is now, but. You know, we all knew each other.
Did you all know each other? I mean, who were the other? You mentioned John Lithgow and Al Pacino. It must have been, again, people that you work with. Of course, your nemesis, John Hurt. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But like at the time, there was John Hurt.
A kid across the street from me named John Hurd, H-U-R-D.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my father's name is Johnny Hurd because he played the saxophone. He had musician friends.
Uh-huh.
And I also had a close friend named Richard Hurt. So by the time I got into showbiz, the name thing was old hat.
Yes. So then how long is it? So you're doing theater, and then how long is it before – is Between the Lines your first film, or was it Chilly Scenes of Winter? Which came first?
I think the first film was a thing called First Love.
Oh, First Love was your with Joan Darling? That was your first film?
Yeah.
And of course, I mentioned
Beverly D'Angelo was in it.
I remember because we showed it. We showed it on Trailblazing Women. It was a quite a little sexy film there.
Yeah. It was about a guy losing his virginity or something.
I know. So you worked.
Well, that's got to be as your first film. Kind of.
Yeah,
kind of
it was iffy because I think at one point they wondered if I wanted to play the lead, and I said no, it's too scary. And I just saw William Catt last year for the first time since.
Uh-huh.
And he's looking good.
Oh, good.
Nice.
The
he's a guy. He's a funny guy. He's the most outgoing guy I've ever been around.
He's pretty outgoing in the movie. I gotta say, as you are, you
he
and Beverly.
His heart broken.
I know,
movie.
I know. It's a sad. It's a really good movie.
Day likes. What's his name? God, I can't not forget his name. He's a great actor.
The older man.
Yeah, he just passed away not that long ago.
Oh, Robert Loggia.
Bob Loggia. Yeah. Bob
yes.
Loggia, great guy.
And how did you like? So, I mean, was that strange that your first movie was being directed by your first two movies?
Yeah, it was, and then it continued. It was Joan Darling. It was Joan Silver,
mm-hmm.
and later on with I can't remember names anymore. You know, Ramblin' Rose.
Right. Now her name has gone out of my head,
it's all you.
And she's such a good friend of mine.
She's a teacher, so we gotta.
Yes, Martha.
Martha Coolidge.
Martha Coolidge.
And somebody else.
Penny Marshall.
Penny Marshall.
You've worked with a lot of women.
PBS thing with, I can't remember her name, Mimi Lederer.
Oh, right.
Which one did Mimi Lederer do?
I think she did the Scarlet Pumpernel or the something.
She did the Scarlet Letter?
Yeah, the cast of the Amontillado.
You know, that, I mean, I know we're skipping around a bit, but that production of The Scarlet Letter is something I saw, you know, growing up. And it's one of the great, I mean, you're laughing, but it's, you're just such a great actor, John. I was so, was that a part that was close to you? I mean, just because you really had, that's a great, if anybody wants to go to YouTube and see your performance in The Scarlet Letter. I think that is a fantastic performance.
Well, Meg Foster used to whack me on the back and say, come on, man, you know, come to life.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, cause
did that work?
Because the character is Dervin Dimmesdale, I guess, is so downtrodden.
Yeah.
You know, she used to tease me and say, hey, come on, you know, let's go dancing or something.
Was that a part of, because I feel like it was the first movies that you did and how I really came to know you at first as an actor was just, you have this kind of likable, preppy cynicism is what mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
is, and then.
I call it, I'm a punk, you know, I'm a wise ass.
But a smart wise ass. You're
not according to my SATs.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you are. But so I want to go back a little bit to the chilly scenes of winter. And you mentioned before, of course, Gloria Graham. And it's a really wonderful film. And again, it's one of these movies that didn't do well on its initial release, but now has really found an audience. And what was it like to work with Gloria Graham? Must have been incredible.
Oh, she was the greatest. She was. We were pals, and we hung out together, and went out and had dinner, and I didn't know enough to know what a great gal she was. You know, mm-hmm. like how famous, but the idea that she was who she was later impressed upon me, and I sort of went, yeah, you know. No problem, because she was so nice. She was like so. She was very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Then actually, one time to a restaurant on Ocean Pacific Highway, and about a year before, I'm going to screw this story up. Uh, oh, Richard Basehart was playing George Washington, and I played a congressman that didn't want to give him any money for his silly revolution. Mm-hmm. And Ed Herman was the opposite. You know, were the two congressmen in the scene that said, no, you ain't getting any more money for this. So a year later, her nickname was Glow, Gloria. Mm-hmm. And Glow says, let's go down the street and get some brunch. And we walked into this restaurant right facing the ocean across the street. It's probably still there. It's right down the street from the Shangri-La Hotel, or what was the Shangri-La. And we walked in, and there was this table of people right there as you come in. And at the head of the table was Richard Basehart. And he jumped up and said, Gloria! And it was all this, you know, big fanfare. How are you? Oh, my gosh, so great to see you. And without batting an eye, he turned and looked at me and he said, hon, how are you, John? How are you doing? And that just blew me away that he remembered me in the company of Gloria Graham. I felt like, boy, I can do no wrong from this moment on.
Yeah.
You know? So that's the Gloria Graham moments. But everybody loves that moment in the movie when she says, the joke's on you.
Oh, I mean, she's, you know... You hadn't seen her movies growing up? I mean, she just was so...
No, not at all.
You hadn't seen, like, The Big Heat or In a Lonely Place?
I was not into movies like that. Mm-hmm. I shout to see, you know, movies. I think like you did.
Was she aware? Because I feel like it was slightly before people were really into movie, you know, like if she were around today, people would be freaking out. But I was thinking at the time that she made the movie, I don't know if movie stars were, once they were not working in show business anymore, you know, once their careers had waned, they weren't as popular anymore. I mean, did she ever talk about her?
She never
mentioned it.
Her history or any of that kind of stuff.
That's crazy.
No, we just sort of hung around. The promenade wasn't there then. It was all run down in Santa Monica. And we just walked around and sat in restaurants, had a cup of coffee, so on and so forth, and talked about whatever. I don't know. Talked about Donald Trump.
Now, another movie that I saw of yours, I told you, I saw every movie of yours growing up, Heartbeat with Nick Nolte, where you played Jack Kerouac.
Oh, yeah. Well, I tried.
Well, now, were you a Jack Kerouac fan?
Yes. I mean, when I got into Kerouac, that was very fulfilling. And I tried to pick on a particular Maggie Cassidy that he wrote. Mm-hmm. I tried to capture his hometown days that he wrote about in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Yes.
I felt like I could identify it with that. I went to Clark University, which is in Worcester, Massachusetts. So
Worcester.
It's what they call the dark American night. There's sections in that book that just make me cry every time I read it.
Yeah. And it's such a, I don't know, he just put such an imprint on American literature.
He was like the epitome of the word dolor, you know, dolorous, the sadness, the kind of triste of... kind of an inner melancholy that it was ironic because John Byram with Nick, they wanted this movie to be fun, you know. and my whole take on Kerouac was that he was like, you know, he was like, you know, it's kind of the American Rambo in a way, you know, kind of just really tapped into your inner feelings, which I can come up with the perfect word for it, but just something, and even in his presence. But he also he managed to combine that with a very French Canadian, garrulous, you know, strength. Mm-hmm. He was very masculine at the same time, and I think it was an interesting comment, which I don't have. So I mean, I was work for me. I was self conscious,
but
I asked to play that part.
I thought what you did in the movie that was very good, and something you did a lot in those days, was you played silences very well.
Mm. Yeah, I was afraid to say anything.
But you always have a very good kind of confused, like as if you're thinking about something, but you're not going to say what it is. Is that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I used to fool a lot of people with that.
Oh, you know? Really? Was that a
fooled Ileana?
You fooled me.
Yeah, I got you, Ileana.
Oh man.
The, yeah, you're just like waiting for me to say something profound, and then I just say something goofy.
No, you seemed, I don't know, you had a kind of, you know, you're like the American Gary Oldman or something, you know, to like a kind of tortured.
No, thank you. He's a great actor.
Yeah. Have that equivalent. You know, there's something deep going on, and I don't know if you're ever going to reveal it, you know. But I love that movie, and I love Jack Kerouac, so I'm hooked to any film that is about, you know, the Beat Generation. Just seems, you know.
Well, it was, yeah, but that's what he wanted, the threesome, I guess, the menage. He wanted that aspect of it to be, you know, entertaining and fun and ahead of its time in that respect, and kind of breaking new grounds, you know, and social mores, and how the three of them, Neil Cassady and Carolyn Cassady and Jack, loved each other enough to not, you know, it wasn't all about sex or something. It was
right.
More about, it was actually about, you know, style of life and art in a sense.
Yeah.
And John Byram always thought that I was being too glum. You know, I was being too downtrodden. But downtrodden was one of the things that Kerouac really, you know, the great fellaheen, which is like the great downtrodden, you know, Mexican peasantry, kind of like the beaten upon, the segment of society that is, you know, gets walked all over.
Yeah.
He captured the heart of, it's kind of like Steinbeck up here, you know, the working man, the kind of the guy that just really has to, you know, give over his life to, you know, hard work and and whatever, however, you know, going from one day to the next,
right?
And how he infused that kind of lifestyle with art, with the ability. Rambo writes about it. It's like the fourth. He doesn't believe that art. He believes that art is an actual vibration. That it's that's why he destroyed all his senses and we have to start all over. And that's why we drop a lot of acid and take a lot of drugs, because, you know, we have to cleanse ourselves of you know, modern day trappings, and to really get to the fourth level where the muse will speak to us and we will experience life artistically. And Kerouac was kind of on that wavelength.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, that's what sort of ushers in the 60s. I missed all that.
Yeah. So I'm trying to do this, and Byram, Johnny Byram keeps telling me, you know, heard, you know, will you knock it off, for Christ's sake? You know, read the Cliff Notes or something. You know, we don't want to. We're not trying to do the Jack Kerouac autobiographical, you know, look at me, I'm the great writer movie.
Right.
And I said, but yeah, but we got to be. And he didn't like the whole idea that actors, you know, he didn't want us to do our homework. Mm-hmm. He didn't want us to read all about the actual life of Jack Kerouac perform him, you know. Wanted the movie to be about the three of them loving each other and having a good time. So he used to go and get my girlfriend at the time when I would be on camera. And my take would be a little downtrodden, to say the least.
Yes.
A little glum. And her name was Mary Margaret, and she would sit. He would put her on a ladder behind the camera, without telling me. And then he'd roll camera and get Mary up on the ladder, and she'd get up there and, you know, make faces or, you know, show me her butt or something, and try to crack me up so that I'd stop being such a pain in the ass.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I've got a whole new meaning now to seeing the movie. Well, of course, then this leads me to yet another movie of yours I saw at the Trinity Revival House movie theater with my mom, Cutter's Way, which is yet another film of yours. So at this point, are you thinking, you know, all of your, every single one of your movies has a specific.
Failed?
No, not. They never failed critically. I mean, that's the thing. They never get a bad review, but they've been discovered And I know you said the French call them second movies. Like they get.
There was the whole article about, I forget what you call them. Got a name for them that was like they've been.
But
like around the block and back.
But like a second chance, you know, which I love, second chance movies. But and Cutter's Way in particular has been, which I think is so interesting. I never would have thought of it as a noir, but it's really been embraced. My friend Eddie Muller, who works for TCM and does a noir magazine, they did a huge profile on Cutter's Way, which I got to read all about. So it's now classified as a noir.
Wow, great. This is black.
Dark.
Dark.
Like I guess because it involves a murder. And so how did you get in Cutter's Way? And you know, how are you involved?
I think Paul Gurian, if you know Paul, he's the smartest man on earth. Mm-hmm. And he and his friend Jeffrey Fishkin wrote from a book called Cutter's Way.
Mm-hmm.
And they went and got Ivan Passer from Czechoslovakia. Those are a million stories there. They're all pretty funny.
Please tell me any of them.
That's somebody you want to hang around with.
Well, Ivan Passer comes out of the sort of Miloš Forman Czech new wave.
Yeah, that's what Paul thought. And then he was terribly disappointed for some reason. And he didn't, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say all this, but he and Ivan had a falling out, to say the least.
Uh-huh.
And Paul was the exec, he was the producer, so, but Ivan said, you're not allowed to come on my set, you know, and uh-huh. So they had a big row or something like that, but it was like, then Paul developed this idea that this wasn't really Ivan Passer, that he was some Czechoslovakian guard that had bumped Ivan Passer off while crossing the border.
I love it.
Oh my gosh.
And taken over his identity to get to the United States to become a famous director.
I love that story.
There was things like that, but I don't know. I'm losing track. What was the question?
it's all good. I feel like Rambo. I'm
a chance to relive all this stuff. You know, I don't.
So you get, and where is the movie shot? Is in Santa Barbara or is
Santa
it?
Santa Barbara. Yeah.
It is shot in Santa Barbara. And you and Jeff, were you aware of Jeff Bridges before? Had you guys known each other?
Oh no, not at all, not at all. He was the nicest guy I ever met.
Mm-hmm.
He was just Jeff is just immediately likable.
Yeah.
And I think actually Paul went and got Jeff and mm-hmm. got his. Jeff's dog bit him or something.
Uh-huh.
So then I think Jeff had to be in the movie after that.
That's a prerequisite. And so, how did you get into, you know, character for the movie? I mean, you'd done Streamers, so you knew a little bit about the Vietnam experience. But the, you know, how did you get prepare for your role?
I drank a lot.
Uh-huh.
And,
what did you drink?
Smoked a lot of Camels, you know. And
what was your drink when you were back? When you were drinking, what was your drink of choice?
Bourbon.
I knew you were. Why did I know you were going to say that?
Bourbon and vodka.
Oh, okay. But that was a long time ago. And what did you get out of all that drinking? Did it ever help your acting?
Well, I didn't drink when I was acting. I drank maybe the night before, and that wasn't really that often.
Right.
I was mostly hungover if I was.
Yeah.
Drinking affected my acting. But, because I don't know if this is true or not. Maybe I made this up, but for somewhere along the line, in the 70s, it seemed like everything was getting a lot more ethnically oriented. That we weren't interested in what you described earlier as the white, you know, mm-hmm. college boy look.
Right.
And I felt like I had to dirty myself up a little bit.
Were you? Go ahead.
I took advantage of opportunities of moving to Manhattan and hung around, you know,
right,
Lower East Side and so on and so forth, and bars and stuff like that, where it's. I don't know. I thought it more or less did the trick. You know, I felt, and I also felt a huge responsibility to guys who had been through Nam. mm-hmm. you know, and that I think was the most, that was the most demanding aspect of it, was mm-hmm. to really try to come off like somebody who'd been there, or, you know, and it was, some people thought it, that I did, and some people honestly thought that I didn't, come across as somebody who was like Alex, where Alex Cutter would really be, mm-hmm. you know. So I don't know. Six wasn't F, wasn't the other, but we were interested in actors more like Chris Walken and Al Pacino and Bobby De Niro,
right?
And we were, you know, we weren't watching so much the John Hurds and the, what I guess later Bill Hurt came along and pretty much a pit, or Harrison Ford or somebody like that. But
well,
things took a decidedly, you know, with The Godfather and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, mob stuff. You know, there was a lot of stuff in the 70s where you felt like, you know, you better get out there and, you know, intermingle. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think my mother asked me many years ago, like, what is the difference in films today? Why are they so, from her point of view, why were they so kind of low class? Mm-hmm. Said, well, you know, because it's not Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant.
Right.
But she said, well, why, that's our misfortune. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, Mom, but, you know, there's a lot of other people in the world that don't look anything like Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant. You know, so, and she said, so is that what you're going for?
Well, is that post Cutter's Way? I mean, so after shooting Cutter's Way, I mean, you must have had a lot of satisfaction in your performance, or do you ever think about things like that?
Mostly, I didn't see Cutter. I don't watch me in the movies if I can help it.
Really?
I just sort of. It's hard enough to just to, you know, listen to other people and to take what they say to heart and take, you know, that let that be the extent of it. Mm-hmm. You know, rather than, and I never really took myself seriously as a film actor, so I didn't do my homework.
What do you mean?
I didn't really go to dailies, and I didn't learn about camera and lenses and so on and so forth. And mm-hmm. It wasn't my first love. And my first love was actually the theater. And I was always, during that period of time, I was very much torn between staying in L.A. and going back to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. You just didn't like L.A. or the...
Oh, I hated it. Hated L.A. Cars, pollution. It's like a parking lot with houses on it.
But so...
Got nothing going for it.
Were there, so after you did Cutter's Way, were there opportunities, or did you just go right back to do the theater?
I went right back to do the theater in several instances. Mm-hmm. You know, plus I had a manager at the time named Bill Tresh, who was pretty ahead of his time or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, he had what we call bi-coastal actors,
right?
And I used to say to people, your career is either going to get a first class Pan Am, you know, TWA ticket, or it isn't. Mm-hmm. You know, and there was that schism or whatever you want to call it at the time. And people would always ask that question: what do you like better, the theater or the films?
Right.
And I'd say, well, they're totally different. Mm-hmm. You know, one does not have much in common with the other.
Right.
Except for there's a performance. But when you can get a running jump at a performance and you have a live audience, mm-hmm. it's almost like a football game. You know, you got to get the ball over the goal line. Mm-hmm. And they're out there watching, and they're letting you know if you are or if you aren't.
Right.
And that's not true in the theater. Mm-hmm. You know? Theater, I guess, involves a whole different set of techniques.
Well, it's more. It's. Are you affected by the audience? I mean, it's the theater.
I mean, film, not theater, but
the.
An audience. Oh yeah, sure.
Well, because in the theater, you've got the live audience there, and I think that's, you know, just a different layer of a component to the performance.
Well, in the theater, you have to tell a story. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of. I remember one time I was had my script at the Chateau. I was staying with Beverly D'Angelo. We did that movie First Love, and she looked at my script and she said, "Jay, why do you have all these words underlined in this? Why do you have this word underlined and this word underlined?" And I said, "Well, because that's my oral interp." And she said, "What? You know, what the hell's oral interp?" And I said, "Well, it's like something I learned at." In grad school, you know, acting class, the only acting class I ever went to.
Right.
And she said, "Well, what is that?" I said, "Well, that's where you put the emphasis in the sentence when you're going to say the line." And so she looked at me and she said, "Well, what if I don't say my line the way you need me to say my line for you to say your line that way?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, then I'm screwed."
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. She said, why don't you just say it the way it comes to you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I don't know. That's what I learned.
Right.
Something.
Did you ever have, when you were filming, did you ever have that moment where you went too far or you felt out of control or even in the theater? Because sometimes, I know sometimes when I've done, I have to do really emotional things, you know, you can't, it's very difficult to shake those things off. Did things like that ever affect you? Like, especially doing a movie like Cutter's Way, you know, you have to go home at night.
And keep drinking?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it's a very powerful, you know, you're playing someone who's just physically kind of demolished, and I'm sure that it must be physically demanding just to play that part, and you're wearing the eye patch. I mean, you know, did you ever just look in the mirror?
It was a real terror. I was no fun to be with or around. And I was probably pretty arrogant about, because, and the irony of it was, Jordan Cronenworth was the DP, and he was handicapped.
Mm.
He had been in an accident or something. I'm not sure what, but he was pretty seriously handicapped, and he was the one lighting the show and shooting it.
Wow.
So me to be standing there complaining about, you know, my arm and behind my back, you know, was, I don't know, he never said anything to me, but I'm sure he hated my guts.
Yeah.
You know, in a sense, but I was more concerned with the life I was more concerned about being a guy that had been through Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
on some level, and more concerned about the lifestyle of being married and being a drunk.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I didn't know if I could cut it as a guy that had really been through Vietnam to that extent and got my arms and legs blown off.
Mm-hmm.
And I had problems with the drinking. I had problems with in scenes and stuff where drinking would have been much more just played differently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to give you a silly example, I would not be sitting at a table entertaining people at the top of the movie. I'd be sitting at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would be, you know, I'd sweep every grocery that she went out and bought off the table, and none of that money would go for food.
Right.
You know, things of that nature that you know, you get all full of yourself when you're acting, thinking that, you know, you can't, you know, this isn't right. I quit.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, the actors are
crazy.
You know.
So now I want to move into, if it's okay, some of your more. And then now you start doing this is the second part of your career. Now you move into the biggest like studio films of the 90s, from what I can gather. But I have to. But wait, we've had Ed Begley Jr. here, and we have to mention Cat People. You know, I would love, having worked with Nastasia and worked with Ed Begley and knowing you, my dream would be to do, we got a show, Cat People, at CineFamily, and have all you guys. Oh, and Annette O'Toole.
All right.
Yeah.
So what was your experience working on that film? Did you ever fear of animals or panthers or...
I definitely had a fear of panthers when they put one on top of me, and I was lying there naked under a sheet.
Yeah, it was scary.
It was like the only thing it could be interested in was my wiener.
Yes. Can I quote you on that?
Well, that's going in the press release, I'm telling you right now.
Well, let's begin with Paul Schrader. So, Paul Schrader, how do you get wind that there's going to be this? Had you seen the original Cat People?
Yeah, I watched the original, I think. Yeah, the black and white.
Yeah.
Insignia Ray or whatever.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful movie. And so then Paul Schrader is going to do, I mean, clearly, did you think it was?
Oh, I remember. She sent me off to a fat farm. He wanted me to be the leading man, you know, and I was very self-conscious about it. He wanted me to, you know, I guess be worthy of somebody that Nastasia would take an interest in.
Yes.
And I wasn't. That just sort of scared me.
Yeah. You know?
So they sent me down to somewhere, I think in Palm Desert or someplace I'd never heard of, and they put me in this all you had to do, though, was walk across the street to the hot dog stand, you know, and there goes that attempt. And he got angry with me because he saw that I wasn't doing anything but charging up a lot of massages and you know,
swimming in the pool.
It was a bunch of women, exercising and
yes.
So he called me up and said, come on. And then I had to come back to L.A. and he got me a personal trainer. And I had to get up and run from one end of Beverly Hills on Santa Monica Boulevard to the other.
Oh, my.
And that, I've had to figure out a way to get out of that.
Right.
I got really drunk one night and I called my trainer up and I said, I don't think I can work out today. I don't feel good. I really hit it pretty hard last night. So he said, well, okay, in that case, never mind. So I figured, wow, that was easy. Just stay like that for the rest of this picture.
So
I'm telling on myself.
Well,
but what was Nastasia? Nastasia Kinski was really nice.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean,
love with Nastasia, I think.
I was in love with her. She was incredibly beautiful in that movie, and that's like sort of the height of her, you know, of her beauty. And again, this is you know, how does one play the lover to a panther?
That is a great question.
I had no idea.
I mean,
it's kind of in the
dark
in that picture.
Really?
Like, what was I supposed to be doing? I mean, I was like, the idea that I was madly in love with her never really, it never really played itself.
Right.
There weren't really moments when I was, you know, I was protective and I was concerned and I was, you know, obviously entranced by this beautiful woman, either the storyline or the script or the screenwriting, it didn't really jump out at me that resonate. I was madly in love with her.
Did you ever have discussions like with, again, Malcolm McDowell, with like, I mean, that it was, or whether things going on off the set? It's a very interesting group of people to put in a movie. Let me tell you. You and Malcolm McDowell, were you ever going, what's going on in the movie? And now we got a panther?
When we went to, that was a different film. I'm thinking of when we went to do Tender as the Night. And Malcolm, I didn't see much of Malcolm then in Cat People. Or Nastasia, I only saw, and I used to hang around with Nastasia's mother, Bridget. And she and I would just hang out, and I think Nastasia was stuck with Paul.
Right. there's a terrible scene with poor Ed Begley getting his arm ripped off. And what was in? I mean, and again,
when you watch that stuff today, it's so. What's the word for it? I mean, it's so. It's not bad, but it's just like, well, with what we have today in terms of of pyrotechnics and people getting their arms ripped off and stuff is so much more sophisticated. I mean, it's so much more real looking.
Right. But I have to say, the Panther's right in there. I mean, and even though it looks pretty scary, I don't think they would be able to work with animals in the way that they did in the film. I mean, you're getting pretty close to the Panther.
They were dyed cougars.
Dyed? Oh, really?
That's what I was told.
What are cougars less vicious?
I would
trainable, assume, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, I don't think. I think panthers are more dark of night.
Yeah.
Cougar maybe. I don't know. It's a good question.
More cuddly.
Well, that's interesting.
Maybe panthers are just harder to.
Now. Another movie of yours that I love, again, had a huge effect on me. This is right when I was in Neighborhood Playhouse studying with Sanford Meisner, and we all went to see The Trip to Bountiful, one of the great movies, with Geraldine Page. Yeah, so just hit it with, I mean, because she was, when I went to acting school, I know...
I don't think that Geraldine was always straightening something out on me. You know,
yeah,
like put this.
Yeah,
that's great. That's great.
She's like that in every movie. You know, the other night there was a movie of hers on with Glenn Ford called Dear Heart. It's from the '60s, and even in the '60s, that's her thing. She's doing that to Glenn Ford, so I think that was sort of part of her character. But
she's really funny.
But tell me about how you got in the movie and working with Peter Masterson, and what that experience was like.
They did a Strindberg, Rip and Geraldine had what they call the Sanctuary Theater Company, and they wanted Amy Wright, and we did these. Plays of Strindberg, one act plays at the Public Theater. And I guess that's how I went on to do Trip to Bountiful with Geraldine. I played Geraldine's young lover in a Strindberg play called, what's it called? I've forgotten the name of it. The Creditors. And Rip was in it. And, you know, there's a learning experience.
Yes.
One time he scared me so much on stage that I thought he was trying to punch me out. You know, like he was pissed off at me about something. But he was really, he was actually really trying to back me up in the dialogue because I had forgotten a line. But he kept, we were on stage and it was in performance and he kept going back to this one question. Over and over again, you know, like, and who wrote the first book? And I was going like, I don't know. And he's like, and we get off stage and I was pissed. And I said, what are you doing, man? What are you trying to do? And he said, I was trying to get you to remember your line, you dope. You wrote the first book.
Thanks, Rip.
I mean, Rip's reputation preceded him sometimes, you know.
Oh, like, yes.
Being a scary guy, but he's not a scary guy. He's a really funny guy.
Yeah. And a wonderful actor, of course, from the old Larry Sanders show. It's incredible. did you guys follow the same? I mean, she seems like an actor that was steeped in preparation and, I mean, the whole movie's.
I don't think so. Geraldine?
Yeah. Well, only because, as I said, my old acting teacher, Sanford Meisner, used to hold her up as the greatest, at the time, living actor.
With the method and all that.
Yeah, he just thought she was...
Then she told me once she brought Rip into that class, and they all thought that he was a genius with the method technique, and then it turned out that he was very classically trained at the University of Texas with a guy named B. Iden Payne. So it just goes to show how, you know... who knows?
Yeah, it's a little taking little pieces. And how did you like working with the director, with Peter Masterson?
Oh, there was the whole family.
Yeah.
Masterson and then his wife and the two girls and everybody. We were all chummy-wummy, you know, down there in Waxahachie, Texas. Mm-hmm. You get like a jigger in your leg and you there for the rest of your life.
Oh, goodness.
You get bugs, they burrow into your legs or whatever, and you got to put nail polish on your over them to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I remember.
That's all. Okay. I ask about Geraldine Page, I get jiggers.
Get jiggers.
Okay, yeah. we got to get to Big. Let's get to now. Yes. How long after that? How? So you? What? One of the things that's so great about your career, John, is that you've done all these classic independent films, but then you also were. Then you go into the studio films, and you're more like the supporting guy, the lead.
I'm the Grover Brooks guy.
Yeah, the Grover Brooks guy, as we joke about. But did you enjoy the big studio movies?
Oh, absolutely. They're the best because then you're off the hook. You know, you're kind of like somebody's going to tell you where to go and what to say and how to say it. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to be, you know, it's actually easier.
Mm-hmm. So working,
and if you stink, you stink. You know, I mean, if then you don't get asked to do another one.
What are your memories of working on Big with Penny Marshall?
No, Penny's.
Yeah.
Penny and I had this big fight one time because she asked me to go over to the water cooler and act like I had a hangover, a headache, or something.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie Awakenings.
Yes.
And she said, just try this because, you know, Robin Williams comes in and asks me if he can use this dopamine, and I say no. And she said, well, you're just trying to give it some other life, you know, that mm-hmm. maybe you're just saying no because you're not feeling good. So I wanted to just see you go, and it would give us some movement in the scene, come out from behind your desk, grab, you know, open your mm-hmm. desk drawer, get some aspirin, go to the water cooler. Take a couple aspirin while you're talking to him, you know, to kind of accentuate the pain in the neck that he's being with this research.
Mm-hmm.
So we would do the scene, and she would call action, and I would get up and from my desk and go around my desk and go over to the water cooler and forget why I was there. And it's just like, cut, you know, and she said, John, I wanted you to take some aspirin. Oh, I'm sorry. And then I did it again, and I'd take the aspirin, and then I'd forget. I wouldn't get a chance to say my line and take the aspirin at the same time or something. It was like too much business for me or something.
Yes.
And she'd say, what's the matter with you? And I go, I don't know. I'm just, you know. So by the third time when this happened, she got, like, really pissed. You know, like, she thought I was doing it on purpose. She thought I was, like, completely ignoring her direction. She said, you know, I don't give you that much direction in the first place, Jared. You can at least, you know, do what I asked you to do. And I said, I'm trying to do it. I'm not doing it. And we got in this big screaming fight about it, you know. And both of us at this, I mean, maybe you had to be there for this moment, but at the top of our lungs are yelling at each other, and both of us looked up, and there was no ceiling. And we were on a set, so there was no ceiling. And everybody had left the room because we were having a fight. Right. You know, and we thought we were in this room and nobody could hear us.
Right.
Oh. And yet everybody in the building and probably a few buildings down, you know, could hear every word. And it was like really super embarrassing. I was always asking her if I was funny.
Really?
And she'd say, yes, John, you're funny. Okay, you're funny. You're just as funny as everybody else in the movie. You're funny, all right?
And another movie, of course, two movies, and I'm going to get to, you know, Home Alone, of course. One time I remember I called you and you said, I'm home alone. I love it. That was my favorite thing you ever did. But with Beaches, of course, again, a movie that came out and people liked it, but now it's a classic. So people.
Oh, well, they did a remake of it. That's why.
Yeah.
Well, no.
A TV show out of her, some TV movie.
They did, but you were in the original. Actually, Allison Anders, our friend, directed the remake. But did you like working with, of course, Bette Midler and Barbara Hershey? That was another really great film.
I called her Barbara Hershey Bar.
Uh huh.
Probably wasn't too original. And. Bette got angry with me because I didn't want to be there. I had lost my, not lost, but I've been reduced to seeing my son every other weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And what turned out to be actually a very meaningful moment was, you know, I was in L.A. and he was back east with his mother, and you know, that's where I wanted to be. And,
mm-hmm.
and one afternoon, Bette, who was easily the hardest working gal in show business, and she had to sing, she had to act, she was taking care of her little girl on the set. She was doing everything. And here I am grousing because I got a couple of lines and I want to, you know. And she finally said, you know, we're the only people working, or everybody else is on strike and you're complaining. And I went, oh, that's not good. So that sort of straightened me out for a while. And then we did a scene where we break up in the movie. And for some reason, Gary, who was just the nicest man on the planet, said, what do you think, John, or something like that? And I said, I don't know. I don't, this isn't working for me or something.
Mm-hmm.
He said, why not? And I said, I don't, it's not my lookout, but somehow it just doesn't feel right to be in her bedroom, in her apartment, like to break up like this. You know, it doesn't seem like this would, I don't know why I felt that way, but mm-hmm. I did. And I said it. And weeks went by when the movie finished, and about a month, 2 months later, I got a call from Gary saying, John, I want to fly you out and redo that scene. You were right.
Mm,
I think we're going to shoot it outside on the steps.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I shouldn't say this, but it was like one of the times I saw myself on film that I looked good. You know, I looked like, wow, now I can understand why. Well, just that 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Come on.
No, I mean, honestly, that's what occurred to me. That's what I thought,
that's,
you know,
great.
At the time watching it. And I thought, well, that was really nice of Mr. Marshall to take my word for it and reshoot this all. That was incredible.
Yeah.
He later, when we were out there doing it, he asked me, he says, John, can I ask you why you're the only actor working in the entire country, and you're complaining, you know, about it, but you want to go home, you don't want to do it.
Yeah.
I said, but, and so I told him, I said, well, I had a child and I'm having trouble, and it's, you know, I don't mean to be a pain, but just it's hard because I want to spend more time with my my newborn son.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me like, oh my God. And I'm like, what? And he said, that's why you're being so grouchy. You know, and I said, yeah, I guess. And he said, well, that's good. That's a good thing. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, because John, you know, most actors are crazy and you don't know why they are the way they are, but you got something legitimate. So I said, well, thank you. And he said, yeah, that actually makes sense. And I said, thank you. And he said, you know, you should always tell your director or something like that's going on. He won't think you're as nuts, just like, you know, all the rest of them.
Right.
So he taught me, maybe, you know, some people out there can be trusted or something. I don't know.
Yes. No. That's such a great story.
Yeah, like a great heart, you know.
Yeah. Well,
oh, he did.
I mean, again, we're running out of time, John, and we're so many movies. I'm urging everyone to look at your work in Snake Eyes, a great Brian De Palma movie. Of course, my obsession, After Hours, Marcy, 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 which it's one of my favorite movies. But we got to end with a little bit just on Home Alone, because who knew it would become, I mean, Christmas isn't Christmas without watching Home Alone.
That's right.
Are you very popular around the holidays when Home Alone shows up on television?
You know, this is sort of interesting, but never. Home Alone was made in 1990, whatever.
Wow.
It's now 2017, and I don't know. I went around and I did an autograph signing or something like that, and.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time ever since this movie was made, people would come up to me and they say, I just have one question for you about, you know, your your character in Home Alone. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what is it? And they said, what does he do? what, you know, he's got like a million kids, lives in this big house. And I said, well, maybe you think I just made this up. But at the time, actually, you know, 20 years ago, I thought that Peter McAllister was a gynecologist. I don't know why I thought.
Sure,
that.
Why not?
But I did, right? But nobody ever asked me that question, ever. Now, like, what does Peter McAllister do? Until the last 2 years. Then several people have asked me that, and I was ready.
Oh.
I had an actor answer.
That's so great. Well,
brilliant.
It's because it's part of, you know, it's such an iconic movie. Just very quickly, you must have had a lot of fun making the movie. It seems like you have a lot of laughs. I mean, what a cast.
Yeah.
Joe Pesci, Daniel Stern, Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, Catherine's my hero.
Yes.
You know, if I could get a laugh opposite Catherine O'Hara, I couldn't be doing too bad. That's, you know.
And
she's pretty funny.
Shooting the airplane scene, just because I did a movie on an airplane, how long was the time on the airplane?
Not long.
Just one day shooting or?
Well, the airplane or being in the airport?
Well, so both. Just that whole sequence of shooting in the airport. Was that in Chicago that you did that?
Yeah, that was in Chicago, right there at O'Hare.
And then you're on a set, right? You're on a plane set.
Yeah, you're on a plane set, and that was fun because we didn't know, and I'm sure Catherine couldn't, even if she did know,
mm-hmm.
how funny, you know, two parents who leave their kid at home can be.
Right.
And how funny, whether they're going to be laughing it up and whacking each other on the back and say, hey.
Yeah.
Got rid of that pain in the neck. You know, so.
Yeah.
We had I didn't have any idea the range of the humor.
Right.
So you saw the first one, and then you saw, well, pretty much anything goes, you know.
Yeah.
So the second one was more fun in terms of being able to maybe goof around a little bit and make stuff up or.
Right.
Lean into it a little more.
Mm-hmm.
There is a moment, and one such moment was when she in the second episode, second show,
mm-hmm.
when we get to wherever we get to, and the luggage comes off, and we're all standing in line collecting our luggage, and then she first realized, and then the luggage comes up, Kevin, 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 Kevin,
yeah,
and there's no Kevin, and Catherine goes, Kevin, Kevin. You know, and falls. She took a few steps back.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, why don't you go the whole length? Why don't you go the whole distance? And she went, okay. And she did a bam, and she did a total pratfall backwards. And I thought, wow, I actually helped Catherine O'Hara.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a good husband.
Well, it's
that's
great.
I don't know why I thought of that, but.
It's such a great film. John Hurd, my very last question is
He never told me how to do anything.
She's not here to say that.
My very last question, I've never asked you this before. Why does Shirley MacLaine thank you in one of her books? She personally thanks you. Why could that? Did you know that? Have I ever mentioned that?
No.
She lists,
I can't imagine why, because I was horrible.
Okay, well, she lists all of these people. She goes, I'd like to thank my editor, or this person, that, and especially I'd like to thank John Hurd. And you don't know?
She's got to get even with me.
Maybe she means the guy who lived across the street.
Yeah, the other John Hurd.
H-U-R-D.
Anyway, well. Shirley MacLaine is a mystery. Your career is not. John, you know I adore you. I think you're a wonderful person.
Been married.
I wish. Well, since you put it like that.
To live.
You've been in, again, so many wonderful films, and we didn't even get to The Sopranos. There's so many, you know, great opportunities for you to work and continued success there, in your construction site there.
Yes, yes, yeah. Indeed.
Hope it all works out.
They stopped.
Yeah, it's nice and quiet now. But you please come back on the show, okay, John?
They're all outside my door listening in awe.
Exactly, because you're fascinating.
As I am. John, I love you. Have a wonderful day.
John.
As we always say.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about myself.
Thank you. My God, we love it. Also, we want to remind our listeners that you can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, out on paperback
and in book.
Bookstores. It's a great book. It's also available on Amazon. Also, like our page on Facebook. Check out our website, ileanaspodcast.com.
Yes.
There will be pictures of John there and all sorts of things.
John, are you on Facebook? Can we find you on Facebook? How do fans reach out to you?
I'm on there. I'm on there.
We will put the link to your Facebook page on our website.
And as we end the show, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is the end of ours. So thank you, everyone. And go see Goyles.
Thank you, John. It was awesome. Thank you.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.